Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my two dear friends, Andre Rodatis and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, Paula. Good morning, Marvin.
And two dear friends and co-hosts, I should say. Chuck is taking a day off today, so hope he's having a great day. Miss you, Chuck. But we'll
see
you back.
Miss you, Chuck.
Yeah. But, you know, here we are. We're starting a new study. We're back after last weekend. Andre and I were both in California, so for fellowship business. And we're back now, though, and we're starting a new study on Paper 70, The Evolution of Human Government. And we thought it would be a timely study to do in light of what's going on in the world right now. Seems like it's in a pretty tenuous place. And the Arantia book, you know, and I know you guys agree, these wonderful papers, the paper on, you know, let's just say the dawn of civilization, 68, 69, primitive human institutions, paper 70, the evolution of human government, paper 71, the development of the state, and 72, government on a neighboring planet. I mean, they really delve deeply into the evolution of our systems and our government, our system of governing, and in our world, which is unique to our world, and in not the basics of it, but just the way it has evolved, and some of the special considerations that affect our world. The things we have to look out for, you know, but also understanding the insightful understanding about who we are and why we are the way we are and why we might be more violent than many worlds are, you know, and even more dangerous. I don't know. I find this very insightful, though.
Well, and I think I just, you know, we've all been thinking and feeling deeply about this situation. So I'm sure all three of us will have lots to say about, you know, in particular, the situation that's unfolding in these last few days. in the Ukraine with Russia and Ukraine and the different players, and just how it represents poignantly and very pointedly the stage that we're at, this peculiar stage that we're at in the evolution of our governmental institutions and our geopolitical situation, economically, et cetera, in the world. And what an intense period of time this last week has been with the buildup of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And just to see the different actors we were talking before we began the show of, you know, the kinds of values that someone like Vladimir Putin represents and that someone like Zelensky, the president of the Ukraine, mm-hmm. what he represents and how they are each comporting themselves and acting. And I'm sure we'll talk about this, but I've had the theme run through my mind many times from the Urantia book, and it's common in the language that pride goes before a fall.
Mm.
And just the way Putin has been acting on the world stage, you know, it's a place of it's a place with a lot of complexity. But there's certainly mm-hmm. pride there, and I actually think he's, you know, as someone who prides himself as a strategist, I think he's missing the bigger picture in a huge way in terms of what's going on geopolitically in the world. And of course we have the perspective of the Urantia book that informs us, so I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation, and applying some of what we read to the current world situation. The history is being made, you know, which is
mm-hmm.
we have felt this a lot in the last few years, you know, with this pandemic and how world cultures are responding, and we're feeling it very pointedly with this situation unfolding in Europe. You know, the greatest armed conflict since World War II, this great Second World War. Very intense time.
Yeah, I think everybody feels the tenuousness of the situation, you know, and I'm so mm-hmm. touched that by the Ukrainians who are willing to die. I mean, and what I've been thinking about a lot lately is, what would I be willing to die for? You know,
mm-hmm.
what
mm-hmm.
would I take up arms? Because that's not me at all, you know. I don't even own a gun. Never have, never will. I mean, I don't want to. But I would defend, and I would not hesitate to defend an aggressor who is trying to rob me of my rights, my right to live, my right to live in a peaceful society, my right to speak my truth, especially truth is worth dying for. There are some things worth dying for. Jesus showed us that, right? He was willing to die for the truth. All the authorities wanted him to do was just shut up and go away. And if he had done that, he could have preserved his human life. But some things are worth dying for. And that's one of them.
Yeah, there was a very poignant video that I saw yesterday. One of the members of the Ukrainian parliament, a woman, you know, young woman by our standards here, the three of us. She was probably in her 40s, and one of the members of parliament, of the Ukrainian parliament, and she's standing there with a Kalashnikov, you know, a machine gun, and she's saying, I never in my entire life ever thought I would be doing this. I've never had a gun. I've never shot a gun, but this is the time, and I'm learning how to use it, and I will fight for the freedom of my country. And what you're getting from these people is that it's not just for them and their current situation. It's for their children
right.
and their grandchildren.
Yeah,
it's for
of course.
It's for the future of their families that they're fighting.
Right.
And that's a kind of value and courage that inspires people to do things that are really self-sacrificing, you know.
True.
And
so
it made
true.
Me think. It made me think. I'm not a violent person. You know, But if it came down to a choice between, for my children and grandchildren, you know, and fighting to preserve a way of life that I think gives them hope and gives them a viable future, that would be worth dying for and fighting for. And this is it seems like such a clear, and, you know, obviously we're at the receiving end of our news media, right? All of us are. But mm-hmm. it seems like such a clear good versus evil situation, the way it's shaped up. The clearest value set, I think, that we've looked at in one of these situations since World War II, where you had Hitler, you know, a true heinous leader. So it's interesting.
Yeah, we like to make him the standard for heinousness.
Yes.
You know, everything changes, and I think that the mistake that humanity often makes is trying to drag us back into the past. We can't ever be where we were 50 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
That will never work. We have to always keep moving forward, looking forward and moving forward. We can't be backward looking and, you know, romanticize about the past, that it was better somehow then. It was different, you know, in some ways maybe better, in some ways maybe much, much worse. But we're on a, you know, it's like the book says, the social ship has steamed out of harbor. We're out. We're out in the open seas now. We have to navigate. We can't go back to the harbor.
You know, part of what's different about this current situation, I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, one of the things that I think comes with the territory with being a leader of this revelation is when we deal with these big world events, we tend, as good historians do, we tend to take a giant step back and look at the where we've come from, where we are now, and where events are going. As far as we can project. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about this current situation that is sort of unprecedented is the degree to which what is happening is unfolding on a global stage with everyone mm-hmm. watching. Real time,
yeah.
Every moment we're watching and we're seeing the values play out. We're seeing the mm-hmm. speeches that Biden is giving. We're seeing the kinds of values that Zelensky is articulating, and we're seeing
right.
the kind of values and the mindset and the vision that Putin is articulating
right.
and what drives him. And something that Biden said that I've heard articulated over and over really caught me, and that is that what Russia and what Putin is doing, and I don't think it's the Russian people. I think it's Putin and his small circle of leadership that are spearheading this. What they're doing is they're creating a situation where the entire international community, even their friends like China, you know, are standing by and just they're not actively condemning, but they can't support them. And the term that has emerged is that it's becoming clear that Putin and his circle have put Russia in the position of being an international pariah. And the
yeah.
entire world community is seeing them that way. So there are powerful lessons being learned here all across the globe, because there are values that are playing out that are very powerful. And it's fascinating to see how that plays out in the context of what our world is struggling to accomplish, which is a true global order, a world government and a world society, and to see how the United Nations is playing its part, which is inadequate. You know, the book says that until there's one world government with a one world police force and there are no more armies, and it's the countries of the world as a whole that determine the course in these situations and mediate mm-hmm. between contending parties. It's like, you know, you have two contending parties, you go to court and that's settled there. They don't take sticks and bash themselves. That's not what we do in a civilized society. Well, eventually the entire world will need to learn to work that way. And what's playing out these days is a incredible, powerful object lesson, I think, for the world as a whole, as to what is broken and what must be fixed. And whether
good
they learn
point.
The lessons this time or next time, I don't know, but that's part and parcel of what's been happening here. That's so powerful, I think.
Here's that paragraph that I quoted a moment ago. It's from paper 99, section 1, paragraph 3. And 99 is, that paper is the problem, the social problems of religion. We studied it not that long ago. It says, Urantia society can never hope to settle down as in past ages. The social ship has steamed out of the sheltered bays and established tradition, the sheltered bays of established tradition, and has begun its cruise upon the high seas of evolutionary destiny. And the soul of man, as never before in the world's history, needs carefully to scrutinize its charts of morality and painstakingly to observe the compass of religious guidance. The paramount mission of religion as a social influence is to stabilize the ideals of mankind during these dangerous times of transition from one phase of civilization to another, from one level of culture to another. Isn't that amazing? So they, in so many ways, they spell out the challenges we face. They know, they see it, you know, and Andre and I were talking about, wow, how long do we have to keep doing this? You know, how long do we have, I just think of decent, good people, you know, they work hard. They play by the rules. They pay their taxes. They do what they're supposed to do. They love their families. They don't have to be rich and famous. They just want to live. And they want to be at peace. They want to be with their families for dinner. They don't want bombs dropped on their head. You know, they don't want somebody dictating their thoughts. They just want to live their life, and they're decent. They're willing to play by the rules. How long do they have to pay the price for, you know, the megalomaniacs of the world? That's what I want to know. That's what I pray about and ask God about. And, you know, often my prayer is, Father Michael, please, restrain the bully, just as he did with Ganon looking on when he restrained the bully and he allowed the little fellow to get away. He didn't judge either one, but he let one get away. And that's sometimes what, you know, just restrain the bully. That's all. You know, the David and Goliath thing is, you know, very poignant to me, Marvin. So.
Yeah.
Anyway. You can tell this is really on my heart, and I know it is on yours and all of ours. I know we all are looking on.
Can I?
Sure.
Go ahead, Paul. Yeah, I wanted to share as backdrop for what we're about to read on the evolution of government. Right, we're going to read that paper 70 or parts of it. I wanted to read some passages from the Vermeule lectures, if you guys don't mind.
Oh, sure.
Would that be okay? And I think it's appropriate even this early in the show because it's what we've been talking about here. So this, I'll just share a few paragraphs from paper 134 when Jesus was traveling before he began his public ministry. And he delivered these Vermeule lectures, and he talked about spiritual sovereignty, and he talked about political sovereignty.
Yes.
In quote, in the affairs of men. So here are a few paragraphs. This is 134:5-2, when he delivered these Vermeule lectures, which they say was the single most largest body of collected thinking and teaching that he did on a particular subject. He was very organized. So this is interesting stuff. And the midwares deliberated. It was after World War II, I think, or leading up to.
Just
before. They deliberated whether to include this, and they decided they would. And it's a paraphrase of what Jesus taught. It's the midwares paraphrase. So here are some of their thoughts. 134:5-2. War on your rancho will never end so long as nations cling to the elusive notions of unlimited national sovereignty. There are only two levels of relative sovereignty on an inhabited world: the spiritual free will of the individual mortal and the collective sovereignty of mankind as a whole. Between the level of the individual human being, you know, for self-determination, right? Between the level of the individual human being and the level of the total of mankind, all groupings and associations are relative, transitory, and of value only insofar as they enhance the welfare, well-being, and progress of the individual and the planetary grand total, man and mankind. And then skipping down a few paragraphs to 134:5-7. As sovereignty passes from smaller groups to larger groups, wars are lessened. That is, minor wars between smaller nations are lessened. But the potential for greater wars is increased as the nations wielding sovereignty become larger and larger. Presently, when all the world has been explored and occupied, which is our current situation, when nations are few, strong, and powerful, when these great and supposedly sovereign nations come to touch borders, when only oceans separate them, then will the stage be set for major wars, worldwide conflicts. So-called sovereign nations cannot rub elbows without generating conflicts and eventuating wars. And then skipping down again to 134:5-10. Your rancher will not enjoy lasting peace until the so-called sovereign nations intelligently and fully surrender their sovereign powers into the hands of the Brotherhood of Men, mankind government. Internationalism, leagues of nations, which is, of course, what the precursor to the United Nations is, and really the United Nations is simply a league of nations. It's not a world government. Internationalism, leagues of nations, can never bring permanent peace to mankind. Worldwide confederations of nations will effectively prevent minor wars and acceptably control the smaller nations. But they will not prevent world wars, nor control the 3, 4, or 5 most powerful governments. And in our world, I think, arguably, we have sort of 4 loci of power. You've got Europe, you've got North America, and you have the Far East, you have China and Russia. In the face of real conflicts, one of these world powers will withdraw from the league and declare war, which is essentially what Russia has done. You know, you cannot prevent nations going to war as long as they remain infected with the delusional virus of national sovereignty. Wow. What a term.
I know.
Internationalism is a step in the right direction, and an international police force will prevent many minor wars, but it will not be effective in preventing major wars, conflicts between the great military governments of Earth. As the number of truly sovereign nations, great powers, decreases, so do both opportunity and need for mankind government increase. When there are only a few really sovereign, great powers, either they must embark on the life and death struggle for national imperial supremacy, or else, by voluntary surrender of certain prerogatives of sovereignty, they must create the essential nucleus of supranational power, which will serve as the beginning of the real sovereignty of all mankind. Peace will not come to your rancher until every so-called sovereign nation surrenders its power to make war into the hands of a representative government of all mankind. Political sovereignty is innate with the peoples of the world. When all the peoples of Urantia create a world government, they have the right and the power to make such a government sovereign. And when such a representative or democratic world power controls the world's land, air, and naval forces, peace on earth and goodwill among men can prevail, but not until then. So, I mean, wow. Talk about...
Could they be more clear?
Exactly. To a T.
Yeah.
You know,
could
so
they be more
we are,
clear?
Yeah, here we are, and what's so fascinating about this current situation is the struggle at this boundary line of our evolutionary progress is unfolding this week as we speak. We're seeing these forces play out, and the virus, the delusional virus of national sovereignty and of a large power looking at its small neighbor and saying, you are us and we will make you part of us. We don't care what you want. That's the delusional virus of nationalism. You know, and what's so interesting is the world is beginning to act as a whole in condemnation of it. Still struggling, but there you see the early signs of global unity in opposition to that mentality, and they faced it with Hitler and in Second World War, where you have a group of nations that have formed an aggressor group. They're trying to take over countries and rule them by military might. And then you had a defender that were trying to stop that process. And, you know, let's not be naive. I mean, there are different ways that countries influence others, but still this kind of naked aggression is what is unfolding again here today. And the world is watching and learning lessons. And at some point, you know, I'll just say this one last thing and then I'll hush up because I've been talking too much here. But someone made the observation that China is looking at what's going on and they're very likely to invade Taiwan. And I couldn't see it in a more opposite fashion. I think China is looking at how America is really leading the free world and the majority of the world's countries in condemnation and now in taking effective steps to isolate and cut off economically and politically this international pariah that Russia is acting like. And I think they're learning lessons. I think they're learning that if we did something similar, and China is a major exporting economy. Russia is not. Russia is a very isolated, small economy. China is one of the three largest economic blocks in the world. And they're looking and they're recognizing that if they were similarly sanctioned, their entire way of life would be dramatically impacted. And I hope they're learning lessons of self-restraint with their nationalism. But, you know, we'll see. But it's all playing out. Right in front of us. Also, I can't help but feel that some of how Putin is acting is Luciferian, just in how he's functioning.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So
unmitigated selfishness.
Yeah. So I don't know what you all. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this
Andre,
situation.
You haven't said anything. We should give you a chance to.
I haven't said anything because I keep muting myself, and I think I'm talking to you, and then I discover, it's going nowhere. So part of what is occurring, I mean, one of the cruel ironies right now is that the head of the Security Council at the United Nations, it's a rotating leadership of the Security Council, is right now in the hands of Russia. Russia is the president of the Security Council right now, and in fact vetoed a resolution brought by the United States that condemned the action of Russia in invading the Ukraine, and having not only the dissenting vote, but also a veto, that resolution did not pass. And at the same time, you know, Putin very cynically invoked, I think it's Article 51 or whatever of the United Nations Charter that said that if a nation required help, or, and I'm not going to speak clearly to this because I don't fully have the text in front of me, but he invoked that article as part of the pretext of going in to act as peacekeepers in those two regions in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and the other one that, again, the pronunciation is escaping me, so I'm not going to butcher it. But those two regions, which have high Russian populations, but there's no actual call by the Ukrainians in those regions for help with quote unquote peacekeeping. And so given that, there is this patina of legitimacy that is being conveyed for what Putin is doing. Now, again, the world, as Marvin stated, is able to see through this pretty clearly and is condemning it. And virtually every other member of the Security Council, you know, condemned this action. But it's showing how this League of Nations, they don't even have to withdraw. Okay? I mean, Russia does not even have to withdraw. Furthermore, there doesn't seem to be any provision to be able to suspend a nation if they engage in war against another nation, at least not one of the leading members of the Security Council that has the veto.
Right.
And this is the problem with the United Nations, is that there's the veto of the most powerful nations on it. The United States has abused that power as much as any of the other nations in not condemning or condemning or whatever various actions of nations through time. And instead of being able to act like a government, it really is a toothless tiger. And so it literally has to stand by and watch and make pronouncements, which have their own power but don't have any real teeth of enforcement. There's really no enforceability here. Under what was just read by Marvin, were we to have a world government that, if it only had the power of, you know, the world's various militaries, it would be able to go in and say, no, stop. And in fact, what a world government would mean would be that all the world's governments would be surrendering their military to a world government. Now, the problem is nobody trusts that a world government like that can be formed, that would not become totalitarian and somehow dominate the rest of the world. But, you know, we do have democracies that can function. Until we get to the point where these democracies become reliable, and right now we're in a period where even the citizenry of various democracies are toying with the idea of going back to less freedom in the sense of being willing to give more power to various autocratic types, and we see that in various countries. We even see that movement in our own country. And as a result of that, is democracy even safe nationally in various nations? If that's the case, how could the people of the world trust a world government to be formed? And yet, they make the point eloquently that without a world government, you you'd never have the power to prevent these kinds of worldwide conflicts.
Right.
Go ahead, Marvin.
Well,
yeah,
what's,
exactly.
Part of what's so interesting is you're absolutely right, Andre, and everyone understands it, that the United Nations is a forum for sharing opinions, but it's essentially a paper tiger. It has no power to enforce in any real way, or very little. But what's very interesting, and why I see this as such a crucial stage in the evolution of geopolitical unanimity towards a world consensus and world culture and world government. Look at what's happening. The United Nations is impotent to enforce. But what the United States is doing, and Biden's leadership, I think, is spot on, and I'll just put it out there. He's not acting militarily. He's not using military power. What he's doing is he's gathering and unifying the world consensus around the values in this situation. He's standing for them, and he's saying, we will act outside of the structure of the United Nations. And through the G7, and it was very striking to me that in the last couple of days, the United States has organized a group of 50 nations, all of whom are concerted in cooperating to sanction, economically sanction, and politically isolate Russia as an international pariah, the current leadership of the Russian government, as an international pariah, meaning you are not, you know, the message is we are beginning to act as a world community on a value basis, and we will take actions that have real-world implications. They're not military, but they're economic and financial and political and institutional, and we will take actions together and in concert that penalize you, that the United Nations has not been able to do, and we'll see how that plays out. But that is extremely significant on the stage of geopolitical evolution on our world. These are new things that are happening, and I'm guessing that what is happening less formally now, it's still happening formally, but it's not on the level of permanent. I'm rather of the opinion that when this is all said and done in the hindsight of history, we will look back at this period of time as tremendously formative of the formal structures that make steady progress toward true world government and world economic coordination, and political and military coordination. I think crucial steps are evolving, even as we speak. That's part of what makes this an amazingly powerful period of time, I think. And I think that Russia looks powerful in the short term, and in the intermediate and longer term, it will be judged by history as a huge mistake and a powerful learning lesson for the entire world community.
True.
But we're in the middle of it right now. And I think these less formal structures will be formalized in the decades ahead. That's what I think.
It's not going to be an easy thing to get to, but it is going to happen. And because that's evolution, and we will get there. Last weekend, Pat O'Banton sang for the Urantia group, and he sang a song that just went through my head the whole day afterwards. It's called Never Give In.
Mm-hmm.
And here's just some of the lyrics from that song. He says, a shame and disgrace for the human race. Still, it's a race they all want to win. So no matter who you are or where you're living, you got to get up and stand up. Try something. No matter how hard, never give in. What did I tell you? Never give in. So what you going to do now? Never give in. All the people in Europe, never give in. All the people in America, never give in. And in the West Indies, never give in. All my African people, never give in. Like in Ethiopia, never give in. Although they are starving, never give in. We will fight against apartheid, never give in. We will never, ever, never, ever in the fight against brutality, never give in. Corrupted heads of society, never give in. And nuclear insanity, never give in. Such a great song. You go, Pato.
Yeah.
Everybody's telling him to go, Pato. Never give in, though. That's the lesson for humanity. We just have to keep up the struggle and never give in. The struggle for truth, beauty, and goodness, righteousness, fairness, decency, honesty, you know.
Well, that's what, you know, you look at this, and I've heard the metaphor used, and it's a biblical metaphor. This situation is like David and Goliath, and you see the Ukrainians in the body of, you know, the representative of the Ukrainian president, but the people as a whole are saying, we will never give in.
We will never give in.
We will never bow to this tyranny. We will fight and we will lose our lives and we will keep fighting until eventually we prevail. And that's very powerful.
Yeah.
That's very powerful.
It is, and I don't think necessarily Russia and Putin especially didn't count on that. He thought it was going to be pretty easy to just go in there and push them around. But he's finding out that they'll never give in. And so,
I think the Russian people are not insensitive to this. I think,
agree.
I think there will eventually be a groundswell that affects the situation internally in Russia as well.
I agree.
There are very early signs of it.
We'll see.
Yeah. Only as the truth comes out. So you know, this, we're seeing that war has taken on a new dimension, and that is that the information aspect of the wars, I mean, they really are approximating more the kind of war that was the war in heaven, where it's a war of ideas, and it's a war of truth against falsehood. There's a lot of falsehood. I mean, the Ukrainian government has been accused of being Nazis, you know, accused of genocide by the Russian government. You know, it's a completely fabricated lie, but by putting that out there, he's making this justification for having to go in. And those information wars are all part of it. But what I was thinking here is that we are about 42 minutes into the show. And perhaps
so
we should... could segue into this. Clearly, this is an important discussion because this really is part of the inspiration for us to deal with Paper 70 and to learn some of the evolutionary aspects of how it is we get to a place like this. So why don't one of you
let's
read this?
Do you want to
begin? Who wants to begin?
Well, I've read some, so Paula or Andre, why don't you?
Well, I'll read the preamble, Andre, and then you take the Genesis, okay? Does that work?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so Paper 70 from the Urantia book, The Evolution of Human Government. No sooner had man partially solved the problem of making a living than he was confronted with the task of regulating human contacts. The development of industry demanded law, order, and social adjustment. Private property necessitated government. On an evolutionary world, antagonisms are natural. Peace is secured only by some sort of social regulative system. Social regulation is inseparable from social organization. Association implies some controlling authority. Government compels the coordination of the antagonisms of the tribes, clans, families, and individuals. Government is an unconscious development. It evolves by trial and error. It does have survival value. Therefore, it becomes traditional. Anarchy augmented misery. Therefore, government, comparative law and order, slowly emerged or is emerging. The coercive demands of the struggle for existence literally drove the human race along the progressive road to civilization. Do we want to comment on any of that or just keep going?
One quick comment, and that is this statement.
Absolutely, go ahead.
This last paragraph that you read, Paula, where it says, government is an unconscious development. It evolves by trial and error. That's very interesting. And I think that's exactly what I was trying to get at in the earlier discussion. The way that Biden is leading, and the way that the leaders of all of these countries are leading, is really a powerful example of this. They're not intentionally creating governmental structures. They're facing an unprecedented situation, and they are, by trial and error, evolving ways of behaving with each other and acting in concert and in unity in the face of this very provocative situation. But so it's happening. They're not consciously forming government, but they are unconsciously forming governmental types of relationships and precedents and culture, really, governmental culture. And what will follow, I think, in the wake of that is they'll look back in retrospect and say, there are things we did that worked, and there are things we did that didn't work. Let's codify and officially and formally organize the kinds of things that worked to prevent this kind of situation again in the future. And I think in that process, what was unconscious in trial and error becomes more permanent and more formal as international governmental structure. We've seen that happening with economic structures like the G7 and the G20 and other types of military alliances that start to join groups together in common cause. NATO is a good example of that. So this is what we're dealing with is a very interesting explication of this this principle that something occurs unconsciously in response to a situation and then gets formalized. Very interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the teachings have about government evolving, I think, and law evolving. It really shows that the next natural progression is for us to evolve a world, a mankind government. Mm-hmm. And, we're a ways off from that. But once we do, we can establish, again, laws that govern the world. And I'm sure even now we could agree on international laws that everybody, crimes against women, trafficking, crimes against children. There's many things we could mutually agree on. So,
all of those things. It's like a reality, like a baby that's struggling to be born. It's in its, approaching its stages of moving down the birth canal. And it's like it's been wiggling its toes and moving and, sort of practicing with all of its faculties. And it's getting ready to be born. And I think we're in the birth struggles, really, of an eventual world government and world culture.
Yeah, I agree. It's trying to be born. It's trying to come. And favorite quotes along this line about law is from Jesus, again, from the Urmia Lectures, Marvin, I believe. It's from paper 134, section 6, paragraph 1. He says, if one man craves freedom, liberty, he must remember that all other men long for the same freedom. Groups of such liberty-loving mortals cannot live together in peace without becoming subservient to such laws, rules and regulations as will grant each person the same degree of freedom while at the same time safeguarding an equal degree of freedom for all of his fellow mortals. If one man is to be absolutely free, then another must become an absolute slave. And the relative nature of freedom is true socially, economically, and politically. Freedom is the gift of civilization, made possible by the enforcement of law. You know, we talk about honoring the rule of law. That's it right there. That's what it gives us. It gives us all a modicum of freedom. But inherent in that are responsibilities to obey laws, rules, and regulations so that every person has the same degree of freedom.
It's interesting to consider, that it's almost being presented as a zero-sum game here, that there's really just only a certain amount of collective freedom that in a certain sense, if you do have that one person that can do anything they want, it means that somebody or some group of somebodies has considerably less freedom because of that individual that's doing whatever it is they want. So that's a very interesting, there are many things that are looked at as win-win, right? Many situations where economically, for instance, if everybody's doing, somewhat well, then generally people are doing much, much better than they would have if only one person was doing well. So that there's synergies that develop. And I'm sure there are synergies for freedom as well that allows things to have, other things to happen that would not happen. But it's very interesting how this is put, because it almost presents it as a zero-sum game. I don't know what you think about that, but it's very interesting to me.
Yeah.
I'll go somewhere with you on that, Andre. This is a really interesting discussion. And please check me, you guys, if I'm moving into controversial and perilous territory. But
oh, I'm sure we're.
Go.
We already are. I'm afraid. Go ahead.
What I believe is going on, and I think it's a huge theater that has been happening the last 10 years, 15, 20 years, and it has been reaching, in a sense, certain kinds of culmination in our culture and also in many other cultures. There's an evolutionary process where sets of values are being played out, lived out, and people are making choices. You brought up the analogy of the Lucifer Rebellion, where people were holding forth for the values of the Lucifer Manifesto and for the values of Michael's plan and the Father's plan. And those value sets conflicted fundamentally, right? And look at the epitaphs that are being bandied about, right? So, for instance, and here's where I get a little risky. Look at the call to make America great again, right? What does that actually mean? How does that actually play out? And really what it's saying, it's a very clever twist. It's basically saying make some of us great and more powerful and others of us less powerful and enfranchised. In other words, make our group great and your group subjugated to us. And that is the agenda of the anytime you see religious fundamentalism, you see it in concert with political fundamentalism, and it is a zero-sum game. It's we want power, so you must have less power. We will be the powerful ones. We will be the elite. And that is in juxtaposition of the true, the fathers and the universal paradigm of true value for the whole, where people must sacrifice for the good of the whole and do so voluntarily and serve the good of the whole in order that more and more people can benefit from the gifts of life in God's family, right? And so look at the value that Jesus articulated. He didn't say, make us great again. What he said was, the greatest among you must become the servant of all.
Right.
Look at that look at what that value communicates. The great among you will give of yourselves to others so that others might benefit. It's the exact opposite value set. Instead of zero sum, it's sum goes to everybody. Everyone benefits. And the least among you shall end up being helped to the front of the line You know, I mean, it's just a fundamentally different set of values. And these values are playing out on the political stages of the world and on the global stages, and people are making choices, you know. And
yeah.
I don't think they're simply political choices. I think they're deep spiritual choices of selfishness versus service, and they're playing out on the world stage. And this situation that's happening so vividly and powerfully is one more explication of that value choice. You know, is it the aggressor that says, I am right and I will take power and subjugate you and we will be great again? You know, the Russian people will once again be great. Or, you know, is it the value set as we must all work together for the welfare of all? They're powerful values choices being put out here on the world stage.
Well, here's another fabulous quote along the lines of what we're talking about, and this is from Paper 12, Section 7, Paragraph 11. Brotherhood, which is what we're working towards, I hope, especially those of us who have read this book, know how important it is to our world to know each other, to understand each other, and to fall in love with each other. So brotherhood constitutes a fact of relationship between every personality in universal existence. No person can escape the benefits or the penalties that may come as a result of relationship to other persons. Well, Ukraine is learning this big time right now. The part profits or suffers in measure with the whole. The good effort of each man benefits all men. The error or evil of each man augments the tribulation of all men. As moves the part, so moves the whole. As the progress of the whole, so the progress of the part. The relative velocities of part and whole determine whether the part is retarded by the inertia of the whole or is carried forward by the momentum of the cosmic brotherhood. You know, you could say it's carried forward by the momentum of mankind government. You know, it's about, you know, what we've been talking about, the collective disdain for what's happening. When the whole becomes more or less involved in what the part is doing, that's wrecking everything for the whole, right? The whole then has the power to correct the errant part and to carry it forward. And this is a great, you know, I saw 9/11 as a similar opportunity to unite the world. And it seems like the world united around that atrocity. But it was far too tempting to use it as an excuse to go and attack somebody, which I think was a mistake myself. But, you know, I think that this, again, is another opportunity for the world to unite against tyranny. And maybe one of these times we really will win the day. And it won't happen again. And, you know, the thing that is scary is, well, you know, you count the cost. What will it cost us in terms of human lives? And I always can't help but think, what gets wiped out? Whole strains of human evolution that can't be.
Some of the best. You know, and we'll talk about this, you know, with the genesis of war and war, et cetera. It's going to be very, very interesting. And it's a high-risk endeavor that we're in the middle of, you know. But the other thing is, and, of course, this we can't really know about in detail. We can speculate, but we do know that the Most High's rule in the affairs of men, right? We do know that the celestial agencies are extremely busy in these times of powerful transition, cultural transition. And they have a mission that they have seen unfold, and they're trying to apply it to this crazy, unprecedented world that we live in, right? what they're dealing with here is utterly abnormal and unprecedented in many ways. But they've seen enough of it in other worlds. They're doing their best to try and help manage it to move the thing forward. And so we're we should, it's interesting to try and sense what the angels are doing in these situations.
I know. Mm-hmm. We should certainly try to work with them, and there's lots of clues in this marvelous book we read about
mm-hmm.
what they might be working on to help us
yeah.
reach this goal. So, Bill, should we continue on with the Genesis of War, Section 1?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Okay, Andre, take it away.
Right there. There we go. The Genesis of War. War is the natural state and heritage of evolving man. Peace is the social yardstick measuring civilization's advancement. Before the partial socialization of the advancing races, man was exceedingly individualistic, extremely suspicious, and unbelievably quarrelsome. Violence is the law of nature. Hostility, the automatic reaction of the children of nature. While war is but these same activities carried on collectively. And wherever and whenever the fabric of civilization becomes stressed by the complications of society's advancement, there is always an immediate and ruinous reversion to these early methods of violent adjustment of the irritations of human interassociations. War is an animalistic reaction to misunderstandings and irritations. Peace attends upon the civilized solution of all such problems and difficulties. The Sangic races, together with the later deteriorated Adamites and Nodites, were all belligerent. The Andonites were early taught the Golden Rule, and even today, their Eskimo descendants live very much by that code. Custom is strong among them, and they are fairly free from violent antagonisms. Andon taught his children to settle disputes by each beating a tree with a stick, meanwhile cursing the tree. The one whose stick broke first was the victor. The later Andonites used to settle disputes by holding a public show at which the disputants made fun of and ridiculed each other, while the audience decided the winner by its applause. But there could be no such phenomenon as war until society had evolved sufficiently far to actually experience periods of peace and to sanction warlike practices. The very concept of war implies some degree of organization. With the emergence of social groupings, individual irritations began to be submerged in the group feelings, and this promoted intra-tribal tranquility, but at the expense of inter-tribal peace. Peace was thus first enjoyed by the in-group, or tribe, who always disliked and hated the out-group, foreigners. Early man regarded it a virtue to shed alien blood. But even this did not work at first. When the early chiefs would try to iron out misunderstandings, they often found it necessary at least once a year to permit the tribal stone fights. The clan would divide up into two groups and engage in an all-day battle, and this for no other reason than just the fun of it. They really enjoyed fighting.
Football.
I know. Right. Warfare persists because man is human, evolved from an animal, and all animals are bellicose. Among the early causes of war were, one, hunger, which led to food raids. Scarcity of land has always brought on war, and during these struggles, the early peace tribes were practically exterminated. Two, woman scarcity, an attempt to relieve a shortage of domestic help. Woman stealing has always caused war. Three, vanity, the desire to exhibit tribal prowess. Superior groups would fight to impose their mode of life upon inferior peoples. Four, slaves, need of recruits for the labor ranks. 5, revenge. Revenge was the motive for war when one tribe believed that a neighboring tribe had caused the death of a fellow tribesman. Mourning was continued until a head was brought home. The war for vengeance was in good standing, right on down to comparatively modern times. 6, recreation. War was looked upon as recreation by the young men of these early times. If no good and sufficient pretext for war arose, when peace became oppressive, neighboring tribes were accustomed to go out in semi-friendly combat to engage in a foray as a holiday to enjoy a sham battle. 7, religion. The desire to make converts to the cult. The primitive religions all sanctioned war. Only in recent times has religion begun to frown upon war. The early priesthoods were, unfortunately, usually allied with the military power. One of the great peace moves of the ages has been the attempt to separate church and state.
Amen.
Always these olden tribes made war at the bidding of their gods, at the behest of their chiefs or medicine men. The Hebrews believed in such a god of battles, and the narrative of their raid on the Midianites is a typical recital of the atrocious cruelty of the ancient tribal wars. This assault, with its slaughter of all the males and the later killing of all male children and all women who were not virgins, would have done honor to the mores of a tribal chieftain of 200,000 years ago. And all this was executed in the name of the Lord God of Israel. This is a narrative of the evolution of society, the natural outworking of the problems of the races, man working out his own destiny on earth. Such atrocities are not instigated by deity, notwithstanding the tendency of man to place the responsibility on his gods. Military mercy has been slow in coming to mankind. Even when a woman, Deborah, ruled the Hebrews, the same wholesale cruelty persisted. Her general, in his victory over the Gentiles, caused, quote, all the host to fall upon the sword. There was not one left, end quote. Very early in the history of the race, poisoned weapons were used. All sorts of mutilations were practiced. Saul did not hesitate to require 100 Philistine foreskins as the dowry David should pay for his daughter, Michal. Early wars were fought between the tribes as a whole. But in later times, when two individuals in different tribes had a dispute, instead of both tribes fighting, the two disputants engaged in a duel. It also became a custom for two armies to stake all on the outcome of a contest between a representative chosen from each side, as in the instance of David and Goliath.
Mm.
The first refinement of war was the taking of prisoners. Next, women were exempted from hostilities. And then came the recognition of non-combatants. Military castes and standing armies soon developed to keep pace with the increasing complexity of combat. Such warriors were early prohibited from associating with women, and women long ago ceased to fight, though they have always fed and nursed the soldiers and urged them on to battle. The practice of declaring war represented great progress. Such declarations of intention to fight betokened the arrival of a sense of fairness, and this was followed by the gradual development of the rules of, quote, civilized, unquote, warfare. Very early it became the custom not to fight near religious sites and, still later, not to fight on certain holy days. Next came the general recognition of the right of asylum. Political fugitives received protection. Thus did warfare gradually evolve from the primitive manhunt
to the somewhat more orderly system of the later day civilized nations. But only slowly does the social attitude of amity displace that of enmity.
But only slowly. What a section that is. It just so aptly explains our tendencies towards war and our evolution in that regard. It really, you know, as you read it, what stands out to me is how much of these reasons we're still using to fight wars have the seven reasons they gave, you know, and which ones are more or less prevalent now.
Did it jump out to you? Did it jump out to you which one seems to be the primary one responsible for the war that we're seeing of Russia against the Ukraine today?
Well, I couldn't help but think it's the revenge excuse, but what do you think? I mean,
there certainly may be a certain amount of that, you know, but
vanity.
It clearly can't be because of people being killed in greater numbers on the Russian side than on the Ukrainian side. Let's remember that that since Crimea was taken in 2014, they have kept up a proxy war with supposed separatists, okay, in Donetsk and the other region next to it. And those two regions have been responsible for many, many hundreds of people having died over these 8 years on the Ukrainian side as a result of these skirmishes. Now, Russia has not taken any responsibility for this, but everybody knows that they have been supporting these separatists on the other side. So there has been that. But what jumped out at me was vanity, the desire to exhibit tribal prowess. Sure, it's a nation, but Putin is behaving very tribally. He's basically showing he is superior and can impose his mode of life upon whom he regards as quite directly stated as inferior. He does not regard the Ukraine as a real nation. He does not regard the Ukrainian government as legitimate in any way and has publicly demonized them to his own people, very much the way, you know, Hitler demonized the Jews or any other groups that he seeked to subjugate. It's clear that Putin has demonized the Ukraine by calling them literally Nazis and saying that we are going to get rid of this Nazi government in the Ukraine, and they seem to be about poised to do that in the next few days, although there's no legitimacy to it.
So here's a thought that just came up on the board from Cam, and Trudy chimed in as well, about resources. And it is surprising that they don't mention that in the book, that wars can be fought over resources. They do mention hunger, and hunger is certainly the main resource that any of us, if you're going hungry, you'd be moved to war. But resources like oil and water seem to me to be one of the things that the world is definitely going to be focused on and has been focused on in recent times. The acquisition of resources and that's truly about vanity too. I'm going to go and take what you have, or I want to use your land to pipe my oil over there, you know, and you don't have the right to disagree. Or you know, the old adage from some of the Middle East wars, what's my oil doing under your sand, you know? So certainly,
you know,
resources are a big issue as well. Resources, especially
I think they are. Well, something caught me, you know, if we're looking for what causes our current situations in this list, I'm not sure we're going to be successful, because something caught me in the header that describes this list. What they say is among the early causes of war were. So I think this is a list of for really pretty much more primitive situations. I don't think it's necessarily applicable primarily to our current situation. Derivatively, yes, resources are related to hunger, security issues, etc. But actually, one of the most powerful statements, in addition to the Ermia lectures, is in paper 195, where they talk about totalitarian secularism and the current dilemma and situation. And I'll just share this one paragraph, which is a complex paragraph, but it is so predictive and prescient, really, as a descriptor of what currently is motivating us, which I think what's motivating Putin is nothing short of raw nationalism. You know, Russia has a history of empire building, stemming from Catherine the Great and Peter, I can't remember, I don't know my Russian history, but it might be Peter the Great. These were empire builders. They were conquerors, military conquerors. They went out and aggressively subjugated the surrounding countries and made them part of their empires. And Putin is cut from that cloth. I mean, that's his set of values. It's empire-building nationalism. And so here's this paragraph, and they say, this is 195:8-10, without God, without religion, scientific secularism can never coordinate its forces, harmonize its divergent and rivalrous interests, races, and nationalisms. This secularistic human society, notwithstanding its unparalleled materialistic achievement, is slowly disintegrating. The chief cohesive force resisting this disintegration of antagonism is nationalism, and nationalism is the chief barrier to world peace. I mean, talk about a set of factors playing out in our society as well as on the global stage. You know, we have a secularistic society, and Russia is, you know, and most societies are nominally religious, but functionally secularistic. In other words, God is not really governing in the hearts of the majority of the people, and certainly in the governmental structures and in the societal structures, the value structures. What's going on are secular values, materialistic values, you know. Get as much as you can, accumulate it, you know, self-centered hedonistic types of value structures. They're not primarily structures around relationship with God and service to other people. Those factors are there too in religious societies. But what they're saying is that kind of secularistic set of values is inherently disintegrative. It will fall apart. It can't hang together in and of itself. And the chief force that's keeping the secular societies together is this virus of nationalism, which you certainly see at play with Putin and in this situation. It's a tremendous sense of the Russian self-identity as a nation and prevailing and having been set back in the loss of the Soviet Union, and now in his attempt to reestablish hegemony, you know, in the countries immediately around them, to conquer them, essentially. And that's why NATO and Europe are watching so carefully, is because there are a whole series of countries that were under the Russian yoke that broke free, and that Putin is desirous of reestablishing that empire. So I think that's what's motivating these wars, is nationalism. Which is a modern cause for war, is what they're saying. It wasn't early on, because there were no nations early on. It was more simplistic and primitive early on.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree, and I'm glad you brought that up, Marvin, because as we've been talking, other things have, you know, occurred to me that for another cause of war, or let's say of some powers getting into war or joining in a war is humiliation. They have felt, and that's a feature of modern times, because as mm-hmm. we pointed out earlier, the world is watching. And the world is watching now even more than it ever was in the past. The world was
yeah.
watching in World War I. The world was watching more in World War II because of radio and other mass communication technologies. But now, the world, the entire world, there is no Iron Curtain. There's nothing that stops the entire world from free access to seeing what's going on. And Russia, I think, I get the feeling that Putin feels humiliated
mm-hmm.
by certain things that have happened in the last 20 years. And we know that Germany in World War II felt humiliated. And so humiliation is another factor, I think, that, you know, when these, and that plays into vanity too, of course. That's part of vanity. When you feel humiliated,
yeah.
then you want to, you know, get revenge. You want to restore your, yeah. you know, the facade that you thought you had, that you were all powerful and nothing could touch you. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, that's...
I think that's right on target, Paula. I remember reading, and I didn't know this, that a couple of interesting facts that have emerged, you know, that I didn't know. One is that Zelensky is a Jew. And so the irony of Putin oh. calling him and his leadership neo-Nazis when he's a Jew and his family members were killed in the Holocaust. What an
wow.
irony, right?
Yeah, that is
pot,
so ironic.
Pot calling the kettle black. But the other thing is that Putin was a low-level spy master during the fall of the Berlin Wall and the loss of the Soviet Empire. Right, he was a low-level spy master. He was rising in the ranks of the KGB, and I think you're 100% on target. He was in East Germany, is what I remember reading, and he experienced the humiliation of the Russians being ejected from Eastern Europe in the fall of the Soviet Empire, and I think he's never recovered. And it's been
yeah.
about revenge and final victory in that battle. And I think he's been nursing it for, you know, 30, 40 years.
Biding his time, waiting for his opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. And building
yeah.
up his, I think it's been a long-term strategy, and I do think it's humiliation.
I agree.
And revenge that fuels him.
It seems like that is also a great motive for Xi, you know, President Xi, is that, you know,
mm-hmm.
he came up in a similar circumstance where he felt like, you know, he felt that the keen sting of humiliation.
Yes.
And
by the colonial powers.
Right.
The China.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's important, that vanity factor. You know, not to underestimate that. And pride does
mm-hmm.
go before a fall. You know, and what can we do to, you know, maybe mitigate that and not make.
See, I do think that the angel, you know, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. I think the angels are actually working behind the scenes as to make these episodes that we're going through very powerful global teaching episodes. I think there are historical lessons that are being learned, and I don't think it's a minor factor that the Chinese are watching what's going on here and how the rest of the world is reacting to Russia's aggression and how the world is acting as a community almost unanimously in vigorous opposition and taking strategic steps to isolate Russia, make them functionally an isolated and really an impoverished country. It's going to be very impactful in the long term if these sanctions remain in place. And I think China is looking at, China's leadership are looking at it, and you know, it's like, wow, what can we take from this? What must we learn from this? And I think China is far more the dangerous adversary in these global conflicts than Russia, even though they're both global superpowers. I think China is an economic giant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there are powerful lessons being learned by the entire global community. In addition to the tragedy of the actual war, they're just, the implications are being observed, I think. So.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Good point.
Yeah, well, we have made them. So, I mean, if anybody is responsible for China's rise, it certainly is the West, and particularly the United States, that has looked at offloading its manufacturing in order to have cheaper manufacturing as being mm-hmm. a net good for the society. Unbeknownst to us, when you support, you know, a regime that doesn't value freedom and make it stronger, it has more sway in the world. And hence it has gone all over the world funding, ostensibly funding the development of other nations, but not without a cost, not without a payback from those nations in their support of China and what it does, and dependency, creating dependency. And this is something that that we need to be very careful about. In Government on a Neighboring Planet, they talk about the idea that nation regards very important the fact that they have a high standard of living, and they understand that supporting, you know, their own economy is very, very important. I'm sure they could probably too, you know, if the other nations were not so hostile, could have gone out and created things, done manufacturing much cheaper. What we have done in the process of offloading our manufacturing is weakened our own economy. We certainly weakened the manufacturing sector in our country, and now it's difficult clawing that back.
Yeah, so true.
Well, there's and I don't know, Paula, if you have to some extent a little bit larger of a window into Chinese culture, if you thought about it and studied it because of your and Glenn's investment and, you know, with May and raising May. And so, you know, you've had a natural interest in that part of the world, I think, that is a little more unusual, I would think. Because I've heard you make observations about Chinese society, and the Chinese pacifist sentiment, I think, is important. Chinese, as a group, have always valued Chinese culture, valued conformity to the welfare of the whole versus the rights of the individual, sometimes to an extreme. But they've also valued larger and larger peace-building organizational structures, which is why they're such a large monolithic country that has subsumed a number of ethnic cultures, and they live peaceably. But there is a statement at the beginning of that paragraph I read, which to me has very interesting implications, where they say, you know, I'll read it again, without God, without religion, scientific secularism can never coordinate its forces, harmonize its divergent and rivalrous interests, races, and nationalisms. So, I mean, arguably, I think there's only one major world society that is vigorously atheistic, and that is communist China. They vigorously subjugate religious any religious activism, because they see it as a threat to their political power, and they're vigorously atheistic. It's the only really remaining philosophically Marxist state. So they actually embrace as an official state policy that there is no God, and they work seriously to push that set of values. And what the revelators are saying is that that's a ruinous system. It cannot succeed. It can never be a successful system for harmonizing human differences and rivalries. Only God can lead to the idealism where we love each other as sisters and brothers and treat each other the way we would wish to be treated. It's only those sets of values that are God-inspired that can give the discipline and the structure that allows people to be truly, truly peaceful and truly prosper. So there is that inherent problem, I think, in modern Chinese culture, having embraced Marxism the way they do. And I'm curious if you've thought about that, or if you have any thoughts, or either of you have thought about the atheism issue in China.
I think that the Chinese people are easy to lead because of their pacific nature. They don't like conflict. It's very distasteful to them. And so they'll go along. And, you know, we see some inklings of them standing up, as in Tiananmen Square, right? And then they're almost immediately quelled and squashed. And but I think that what China is doing and what secular governments are doing is trying to replace the love of God and the loyalty to God and the concept of ultimate truth, beauty, and goodness to the party, you know, or to the government. And
ultimately to the leader. To the leader.
Right.
It's almost easy.
And so,
they almost have to make him a deity figure.
Right. They have to make him. And so the only way to resolve that is for everybody to bow down before the great imperial leader, the human, you know, the head of the party. And the only way mankind, from our book that we love so much and teaches us, the only way we'll ever find real peace as a world is when we surrender that sovereignty to God alone. And so maybe they inherently know that if you surrender your sovereignty to God, then you're not going to give it to me, you know?
Yeah.
So therefore, there is no God. I refuse to let you have that idea. And to me, the absurdity of trying to fight an idea, especially an idea that wells up from the depth of the human soul, they cannot fight this idea. They will lose. It's inevitable they will lose. They have chosen the lesser. The greater will win here. It's just a matter of time. And sooner or later, the Chinese government and all governments of the world are going to have to realize that the greater concept is the first source and center of all things. And that, we owe allegiance, we should surrender sovereignty to God. God alone is sovereign. Once we do that, we gain the requisite humility to realize we're not perfect. There's no human way of doing things that is perfect. And that we need to join together and listen to each other. Learn to love each other. I mean, these are themes that are throughout the whole Urantia book, right? Get to know each other, learn to love each other, become familiar with each other's cultures and literature and ways of living, and listen to each other. And, be humble before God, the creator of all. Be willing to surrender your national sovereignty to a greater sovereignty, which is God. And the whole, maybe the whole world will come along with that. And I have to also point out in paper 195 is so amazing because, and you read from it earlier, Marvin, because it kind of puts a cap on all of this. And it's what the midwayers are telling us. They've been hanging out here with us all these thousands of years. They know us so well. And they can really pinpoint the places we're missing completely missing the mark. And this is just one section from paper 195. It's section 10, paragraph 20. They say Christianity represents the Western world. Christianity suffers under a great handicap because it has become identified in the minds of all the world as part of the social system, the industrial life, and the moral standards of Western civilization. And thus has Christianity unwittingly seemed to sponsor society which staggers under the guilt of tolerating science without idealism, politics without principles, wealth without work, pleasure without restraint, knowledge without character, power without conscience, and industry without morality. And as they so often do, you can flip that and say, okay, you know, let's hold up the idea of wealth with work, pleasure with restraint, knowledge with character, power with conscience, industry with morality, science with idealism, politics with principles. I mean, you know, it's just a recipe for us right there.
Well, you know, what's so interesting, and I'm not a great student of Marxist philosophy. I mean, I don't know it that well, but I know it some. And you look at the historical context within which Marx created that philosophical and value system, and it was right in the middle of the throes of Western civilization, or elements in Western secularistic society, basically throwing off the oppression of the medieval church, you know, the Catholic
right.
Church and the Orthodox Church.
The totalitarian,
church,
right.
The totalitarian church, right, which the book talks about. And Marxist philosophy was a direct response to, they saw religion as the opiate of the people. It was a way of power control of the elite, the religious and political elite, to control the masses. And that's how they saw their world. Well, the Chinese have embraced that as part of their own self-conception, in contradistinction to the West, as exactly from the passages you described, Paula. They see the West and its culture as a Christian culture, and religion
right.
as a subjugating colonial force, right? That's
right.
how it was used against them. It was part of the power structure of colonial Western powers occupying China. And that's the cradle out of which Chinese Marxist communism was born. That's how it emerged historically, in direct opposition to that. The issue is that the inherent spiritual hunger of their own people will never rest with that system. It's not sustainable, because it doesn't meet the fundamental spiritual needs of humanity, right? So,
right.
so you know, China
so
is
basic.
Just a... It's a situation waiting for dramatic transformation spiritually, and eventually, if what we believe what the revelators tell us, it is inevitable that the Chinese people will have a future profound spiritual awakening and embrace the advancing ideas of God and relationship to God, because it is inseparable from human nature, that hunger, and it will find its way out. You know, it's the communist rulers there are, it's an illusory belief that they can maintain a non-spiritual, non-deity system. What's also interesting in that light is, you know, the foundation is just currently moving on the last stages of preparing a really high quality, they've worked at it for 20 years now, high quality Chinese translation of the Urantable, and they're preparing it in two ways, and with both sets of characters, the popular and the more traditional character, which covers the entire Chinese population of what they're literate in. And they're working substantially, I think, with people from Taiwan, Nationalist China, Taiwan, not Communist China, but these people, the Taiwanese, have tremendous inroads into all of communist, they have family ties, and they're tied into all of communist China. So, you know, I think the revelators with the Chinese are playing the long game. I think that eventually, and there's lots of underground spirituality in China. So I don't think that communist system can last if what this paragraph tells us is true. It's just not sustainable. So that'll be very interesting in the decades and centuries ahead.
And you know, Marvin, in terms of China, what has really, really helped me is a section in the Urantia book from paper 79, and that expansion in the Orient. And it's section 8, later Chinese civilization. And the revelators really give you a picture of how they view the Chinese and the sons of Han. And they view them as being actually a remarkable people who have done many, many, many things right and have given much to civilization. And they also predict that they will, you know, once again take their place, which, you know, we're kind of seeing the beginnings of that. And so,
well, you know, in terms of genetics, you know, they're one of the three primary races. You've got the blue, the red, and the yellow. The red has largely been decimated and incorporated into the proto-white cultures. So there's not much of that inheritance. And they say significantly the red race never did receive any Adamic uplifting. So they missed out on that because of their isolation in the American continent.
Right.
But the Chinese, I mean, the yellow races did receive some substantial Adamic uplifting. The Andonites got out there, especially the northern Chinese, and the Europeans received the bulk of it. But what you see happening now, and you see it substantially in the United States, is the mixing of the blue and yellow races. And I think, you know, I think there's all kinds of potential happening in these mixtures of some of the more advanced racial groups and some of the best remnants of every racial group. And that mixing, as they say, is happening primarily in the U.S. You see some wonderful examples of human nature and human culture happening as a result of race mixture on all levels here in this country.
True.
And to some extent in Europe. So I think the angels and the midwares are hard at work on that front as well, in developing internationalism.
Poor things, they have so much work. This planet. My heart always goes out to them. I think, okay, what if I had to deal with the problems that you deal with? But it's a good thing that they have the long game perspective, right? Which they do, and we don't have that. That's one of our great detriments as a race on a planet. We don't have. We're not forward-looking. We don't have, you know, the long view.
This is a very busy place, and I'll bet you our angels, when they mix with angels from other worlds, I'll bet you the angels from other worlds look at our angels and our midwares and say, wow, what an incredible opportunity you guys are having to deal
hats
with
off
these
to
situations.
You.
Hats off to you. Right.
Yeah, hats off. Yeah, truly. They are heroes. We are too, though. Think about what we deal with every day, you know, and we carry on. We find grace and dignity and love and peace. We find those things. We look for them and find them, and we share them with each other whenever we can. And that's one of the most beautiful things about our world, I think, what we've been able to accomplish in spite of all the things that have gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate that about us. And that we're so hopeful always. I think the biggest crisis of humanity, as I see it, is that we have erroneous ideas about God, or we just don't believe in Him at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
which,
pretty ruined.
Which says that we have erroneous ideas about God.
Right.
To not
that
believe
one
in
leads
him at
to
all.
The other. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Thinking people reject him because of the erroneous ideas. So they can't figure out that that's not who God is, but that's how imperfect man tries to see him. You know,
well,
you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater there.
Well, and you know, there are sort of three large realms I'm used to thinking of in terms of so how to say it, existential senses of what reality is, right? There's the sense of who I am, what a human being is, and what a human life is, you know, what the purpose of life, the nature of humanity, right, in a profound philosophical sense. Then there's the nature of the universe and what we're part of. And then there's the nature of God, you know, and the teleological issue. Where are we headed? What are the ultimate realities that anchor the rest of reality? And none of those three areas make sense without the other two. And none of it makes sense unless you posit God. In other words, who we are and what we're part of, what this life is, makes no sense without the concept of a God that anchors all of it and has created all of it. It's absolutely nonsensical, and it's futile. And it's profoundly uplifted and made meaningful and deeply valuable when you understand that the whole thing is about our relationship with God and our relationships with each other that are changed by our relationship with God. That's what the whole thing is about. The universe is simply a stage for this remarkable personal and relationship drama that is unfolding. It's all about relationships and love, you know, between persons. And when you understand that, then all of these geopolitical questions and all these complex questions, they begin to fall into place, because the fundamental value set is then clearly and rightly established. You know,
right.
Without that, you don't have a system that works. Without that, it's not sustainable.
It's not. None of it is. It will never get you there to where you want to be without that.
Yeah.
So that's our challenge, right? How do we, live in such a way that restores people's faith in God? And that's why I burned to share the Urantia book, because the truth it shares about God is so profoundly beautiful. You know, in my own life, that's what I searched for. That's what I wanted to know. I knew God in my heart long before I found the Urantia book. And the Urantia book affirmed for me the God I already knew. And the teachings about God that I rejected, I knew, thankfully I understood that I wasn't rejecting God, I was rejecting the teachings about him. And I was able, because of certain conversations I had as a young and impressionable teenager, I was able to sort out the difference between man's imperfect view of God and the reality of God, the reality of the first source and center. And,
you were lucky.
I was so lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I was so lucky. I still remember a conversation I had with a fellow about the Bible and biblical inerrancy and whatever. And he expressed to me how, through the years in translation, a lot was lost. And he used as an example the teaching of Jesus on the cross as he speaks to the thieves on either side of him. And in King, he pointed out, he just so happened to have two versions of the Bible, and he pointed out in one it says, "Truly I tell you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise." And the next one says, "Truly I tell you, comma, today you will be with me in paradise."
Hmm.
So just by moving a comma, one word, the whole meaning was changed. And confusion ensues because, well, wait a minute, he died and he for 3 days and then he ascended. So how could he be in paradise with this guy on that day? It wouldn't be possible. That's an error. The first one he read, "Truly I tell you today, as I'm speaking to you right now, truly I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise." And, it just that one conversation I had with that guy, I think I must have been 16, 17 years old. I thought, wow, he's right. You have to be very discerning. And you have to understand what gets lost in translation over centuries. And how moving one comma can change the whole meaning of a sentence. So
you have to
just take it all with a grain of salt.
This brings up a sort of an interesting tangential subject, you know, because it's not really focused on our main topic for today, which is this whole issue of governmental evolution and war and the evolutionary nature of war. And we still have another section, which we'll probably get into next week, I imagine, on the social value of war. But there's this interesting question that you bring up with, you know, the comma and the translations. And interesting, Paula, And I thought about it, really kind of thought about it, cogitated about it quite a bit. Why is it that Jesus was enjoined from putting anything in writing? He was prevented from doing, creating any kind of a permanent written source. And he could have written something brilliant, you know, at least as high quality as what we have with this this fifth epical revelation. And ironically, rather than having a person in this sort of emergency revelation we have now, everything is in a written permanent form. And we've been instructed, and we've so far been faithful in keeping the text unchanged in any way. The value of keeping it in its original form was highly emphasized. And, of course, we have translations, and those translations we argue about endlessly, which is fine, because that's the nature of translations. But we don't argue about the original text, and that's critically important. So why is it that there was such a diametrically opposite approach in the fourth epical revelation versus the fifth? And I think it has entirely to do with the cultural context and the historical development that's happened in the last 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. They had no way of permanently guaranteeing, if Jesus had put stuff in writing, what would have happened inevitably is it would have been changed and distorted, because they had no effective mechanisms of guaranteeing the permanence of a text. They just didn't have those societal, they had no printing press, and they would have discordant claims. So you would have had the masters writing this version and that version and claim this and claim that. It would have been very destructive. And I think that's part of why they did that. And we live in a time, interestingly enough, where the rapid spread, almost instantaneous spread, of a uniform, fixed body of revelation can be made available and be done so safely and securely. And that's a very different societal context and technological context than existed 2,000 years ago. And look at the value of us having a permanent text. We can argue endlessly and speculate and try to interpret, but we're not arguing about what the original communication is. We're discussing and discovering our speculations about what the revelator said, which is so much better a situation. I mean, there's been so much misinterpretation about what Jesus actually said because of that problem. And we are so lucky not to have that particular problem with this revelation. So that's a very interesting difference to me.
Yeah.
Why they put so much detail in permanent form and gave it to us. Very interesting.
Without a doubt, and how blessed we are to be able to turn to it and go back to it and study it and search it and, you know, how it's evolved in our own social understandings, how a little community around it has evolved and how various access points to it have evolved. And even it has evolved tremendously. Now it's all over the World Wide Web. How great is that?
Yeah. I think there's another aspect, though, that is important to point out. You know, one of the things that would have happened had, you know, Jesus put things in writing. I mean, we see how we are with relics and everything else, and it very, very quickly would have been made into a fetish. And it doesn't matter who you are and what you write. There are any number of things that can be fetishized and turned into something that is creedal and therefore immutable and needs to come before even the goals and values that are being put forward by the faith that arises out of something. And he knew that truth has to be living, has to be inconcussable. The difference here with this revelation is that there is no way for this to become a fetish in exactly the same way. If it becomes a fetish, it's because you have made it so. Okay?
Right.
It itself has the seeds within it of saying, do not make this a fetish. Because it says there is no such thing as a sacred book. You know,
right.
It is a revelation. It is not a sacred book. And that is very, very important as well, because they do not want this to become a fetish. They want it to be living truth. Learn what
right.
you can, then how do you apply it? And then as you apply it, how can it be lived out? That's the most important thing about any revelation, is how it takes on life, how a belief forms around it. And I know you weren't saying that, Marvin, but what I'm saying is that is another key aspect of this. Had Jesus actually written things down, it would
yeah.
have become a fetish. There's no question.
Absolutely.
Well, it's
and
the
people
truth
kill
about it,
over
the
fetishes.
Truth.
They hurt
it's
each
the
other
truth.
Over fetishes. You know?
Yes.
They do.
It's the distinction between the truth about and the truth of, right? So, you
mm-hmm.
know, they make a big deal about the truth about, you know, the gospel about Jesus, which is what the fetishization is. And it,
mm-hmm.
it has occurred in anyways. And the religion of Jesus, which is the way he lived, that was transformational.
Right.
And so the question is, you know, can we make the mistake of making our movement, our culture, the religion about the Erasmus? Absolutely. I think we can. And I think, I think in some ways we have, in hopefully not majority ways. It's an easy mistake to make. It's easy to get excited about the phenomenon of the Urantia book. And really what they're saying is, in all of this is about a transformed way of living. It's a way of living in powerful, transformed relationship with God. And all of what flows from that and every other instrumentality that helps you with that is simply an aid to that end. It's not
right.
the end itself. And, you know, I mean, I think it's an ongoing challenge that our evolving Urantia movement culture continues to struggle with, is to not drift into it being the religion about this book, you know.
Well, I'll tell
we
you,
have to watch
what
it. We have to watch against it.
I think that we came dangerously close to fetishizing it, to the point where it became more sacred than we are. It's like Jesus saying was man created for Sabbath or Sabbath created for man. And I used to think, was man created for the Urantia book or the Urantia book created for man? You know, if we weren't here, it wouldn't be here. And I think the fact that it is now free of you know, nobody owns it.
Exactly.
You know, yes, it's true that some people can change it, and they will, and they probably already have, and that's one thing. But no one can hurt another person in it, you know, for the sake of keeping it just exactly the way it's always been. And, you know, it came dangerously close to being a fetish, you know.
It became a power struggle over a piece, in a sense, over a piece of territory, religious territory.
Right, exactly.
And we've negotiated our way pretty successfully. I think we've accomplished two things that are hard to accomplish side by side. One, that the text is preserved in its original state and has been proliferated massively, both in hard copy and on the web, so that there's very little danger, even if there are minority translation or editions of it that change this or that, they remain dramatically the minority, hardly even noticeable.
Right.
And the text itself is preserved in its inviolate state, its original state.
Right.
And we've managed to do that in a way that hasn't put one group of us in a power relationship to all the other groups in a way that is perceived as subjugating. And so, you know, whether we did it artfully or we did it in a messy way is open for discussion. It was
but
not
the result
fun.
Is still the same.
But the result is we've accomplished
yeah.
those two critical purposes, and we are well on our way. So I think someone deserves pats on the back, and it's probably the angels and the midwares, frankly.
Yeah, there you go. Well, we're out of time, and that's wonderful because it was a great discussion. Thank you so much. Thank you to our listeners on the board and those who will listen to the archive. We appreciate you. We're happy to do it. We love it. It makes our day, makes my Saturday every Saturday. I look forward to it. And so
absolutely.
Next week we're back with Section 2, The Social Value of War, and that's going to be a great section. That, you know, that's an insightful section. You say, wow, I never thought of that, but it's a great one. So I hope you'll come back and join us. And Marvin and Andre, thank you so much.
Thank you, you guys, as always.
Yeah.
Thank you to our listeners.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you all.
Take care.
And we love you. We send you lots of love.
Lots of love.
Yes,
yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Well, have a wonderful week.
Well,
and bye for now.
You too. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.